Morning, everybody. Welcome. My name's James Walters. I'm chaplain of the London School of Economics, and I want to welcome you to the LSE Faith Centre, especially if it's your first visit here. It's a particular pleasure to welcome Sister Teresa Forcades to speak to us this morning on the topic of faith and politics. When we planned this event, I did not foresee the political turmoil that Europe was going to be thrown into this week with such a clear cry of dissatisfaction expressed in the outcome of the European elections last week. But I suspect that Sister Teresa will say that she did foresee such an outcome, because she has for some time been pointing to the looming crisis in our society, the failures of our systems of governance, and particularly Europe's embrace of the neoliberal capitalist model. She's Benedictine nun at the monastery of Montserrat near Barcelona. She studied in America and in Spain, and she holds doctorates in theology and in public health. She's an outspoken activist on Catalan independence and on issues of justice, both in the church and in wider society. So Sister Teresa is going to talk for about 45 minutes, and then we'll have the opportunity for questions and some discussion. We're recording this for a podcast that will go on the Faith Centre blog later, so you can play it again and direct your friends towards it. And Sister Teresa, we look forward very much to hearing what you have to say. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. So thank you for the invitation and for the opportunity to talk today. I would like to address the topic of faith and politics today from a theological perspective. Yesterday I was here in London, and I was able to address the political activism in more direct fashion, and heute, today, if there is this dialogue afterwards and you want to ask questions, I can entertain all kinds of questions. But in my presentation, I would like to address two very central and important theological themes that, it seems to me, can help us illuminate this relationship between faith and politics, and those are the notion of co-creation, a very particular notion in the Christian theology. Co-creation, what is this? And the notion of perichoresis. And perichoresis is also a technical term to speak about the Trinity. And I think that also is something that can help us inspire a politics that go in the direction of the gospel, I hope. So the first point about co-creation, I would like to start, of course, naming that today for many people, this idea of believing in God, that God exists and that God gives a meaning to life, it's not an obvious thing, right? In the history, it seems there has been some centuries in which that for the majority was an obvious thing. Today is not anymore the case, but it's even less the case when a group of believers, like the Christians, and of course, what I'm going to say now affects the Catholics, but I think the Anglicans too, that we not only talk about God, but we have this figure that we talk about as the Mother of God. You do that too, huh? Like, so the Mother of God is for the Orthodox, and actually this expression, Mother of God, it comes from one of these great ecumenical councils at the beginning of the Church, which is the Ecumenical Council of Ephesus in 431. The name in Greek was Theotokos, and one of the main points of this council of 431, the 5th century, was to discuss whether that was an appropriate title to use or not. What does it mean to speak, to give the title of Theotokos, we translate it as Mother of God, to give that notion, that title to somebody? In that case, Mary of Nazareth, but is this possible theologically, and what is the meaning of that? As I said, hard enough for us today to defend the idea of God, but if we put it the Mother of God on top of that, that seems that it adds difficulty, because if somebody wants to have still in the 21st century a notion of God, a notion of this being that represents the horizon of meaning and of significance, then what does it mean to speak of a mother of that? What is this? It's like a goddess that's bigger than this God? How can we understand this relationship, and how can it make sense to us? The problem with this title Theotokos, or Mother of God, is not only for us in the 21st century, it was problematic in the 5th century as well. And there is this fight between Cyril of Alexandria and Nestorius, two of the main theologians of that time. Basically, Nestorius said this is an absurdity. to use the term Theotokos, Mother of God, we should call Mary Christotokos, Mother of Christ. That's okay. She was Mother of Christ. But don't even try to call her Mother of God, because this is like a contradiction of terms and a deep contradiction with what we believe. At the same time, Cyril of Alexandria would be the main representative of those who said it is not only appropriate but very important to keep this title of Theotokos and speak of such a thing as the Mother of God. That was a fight that, as you know, most of you, was resolved in favor of keeping that title. But what interests me is not to do history of the Church at this moment, of the theology, but to try to see if that can have any meaning for us today. And to do that, I would like to call into the play a theologian of the 17th century, a woman theologian in Spain called Maria of Ágreda. It's maybe not well known here, but it's an important theologian of the 17th century, Maria of Ágreda, and she writes a book where she devotes, the whole book is about Mary, and this is at the time that she writes 800 pages, and then this book is actually put in the blacklist, because this is before certain dogmas of Mary in the Catholic Church were approved, so she was, in that sense, a marginalized figure in her time. But she writes a very important chapter in this book where she poses this relationship that Luke in the Gospel explains to us between Mary and Gabriel, the announcement. She poses that in the center of this chapter, and she lets the subjectivity of Mary come to the fore, which in the 17th century is not something that usually was being done. Usually it was thought of Mary as being this human being towards which we can have a very clear relationship. So it's thought of as being like an instrument of a greater power. This is the power of God, and that's about it. Not for Maria of Ágreda. Maria of Ágreda pauses and says, this conscious action, this conscious relationship between what we call God and what we call a human being made to the image of God, they find each other, they talk to each other, and there is something possible because of this interplay of free spirit, of this interplay of free inter-dialogue or free exchange between the person of God and the person of Mary. That's how Maria of Ágreda talks. And she says something, which basically is what I wanted to mention now. She says, when Mary says, be in me, or I know the quotes, of course, in Catalan of the Bible, but so let be in me what, according to your word. You say like this, right?
Yes.
So, geschiet, that's in Dutch, okay. So that in me, it happens according to your word. Maria of Ágreda asks, to what word? When the Gospel of Luke says that, Mary to the angel says, be done in me according to your word. To which word is Mary talking about, or is Luke in the Gospel talking about? And Maria of Ágreda says, let us look in the Bible, what is the first word that God pronounces in the Bible? Can you tell me?
Let there be light.
Yes, the first words of the Bible, of course, are at the beginning there was, but that's the first words of the Bible. But the first words that the Bible records as God having said, this is let it be light. So this theologian of the 17th century takes that and says, let it be light. Let's think about this light. What kind of light is that? Is that the light of the sun? What do you know from Genesis? Is that because Genesis, that's in the book of Genesis, the book of Genesis is about creation, so of course it's about creating everything, also the light of the sun and everything. But this first expression, let it be light, to what does it refer? Does it refer to the sun? What do you think?
It has not been created.
What?
The sun has not been created yet.
Okay, that's in the fourth day, right? This let it be light comes at the beginning of creation, according to the narrative of Genesis. And the sun and the moon, by the way, both of them, they are created in the fourth day according to this narrative. So it cannot be that this let it be light refers to the light that we call the physical light of the sun. Also, a little parenthesis, it's interesting in the comparative between religions that basically there is a pun in the book of Genesis, because the Hebrew words being used by the sun or for the sun and the moon in the fourth day are words that we should translate. We usually say in Spanish, astros divinos. I don't know in English how you translate this. The
divine?
Divine. Okay, divine.
Astron.
Okay, so that's quite neutral and respectful, but the Hebrew word is pun, right? Because it says, like our Spanish would be, la pequeña lamparita del cielo. So the The little lamps up there. Because, of course, the author of Genesis, this is, we think, the priestly author in the 5th century, it's within the context of Babylonian exile, is trying to separate this faith of the Israel community from the Babylonian myths that have to do with the worshipping of certain of the natural elements. So it says that little lamp out there, right? They were created in the 4th day, but they have nothing to do with God. God is not the little lamp up there. We are not sun worshippers, right? So that's a pun that's interesting to know. But to the point is, clear in the Genesis story that this let it be light has nothing to do with the physical light. So what is this light that need to happen or need to be present at the beginning in order that creation happens? This light, we have to put it in relationship to something that we, I think in English also, we call the century of light or siglo de las luces.
Enlightenment.
The enlightenment, right? This word enlightenment has to do with this light because it's the light of meaning. It's the light of when we say, ah, I see that. You say that in English too, right? That you are with a difficulty, you don't understand, something appears to you obscure, and suddenly these words obscure, and suddenly it's like, I see that. We use metaphors of seeing, of illumination, of light to express meaning or to express understanding, to express something that makes sense, right? So this sense or this meaning has to do with light or something being enlightened, and that's being used also in the Enlightenment century in that sense, because supposedly some people came that helped us move away from obscurantist mythologies and religious mystifying of reality, to go, according to the rationalist of the Enlightenment, to a path of clarification and of light, meaning, sense in that open way. Okay, so if that's the light of the meaning, that makes sense because this light we can relate to Jesus in the sense of also the theological notion of logos, which is something that the world, for a Christian, it's not an absurd thing, right? It looks like it many times, I grant that, when you look around your own life, and you look around the political surroundings and you might think, okay, I don't know if I can speak of meaning because that seems to me very absurd. And there are too many things that don't actually fit and are difficult to give a sense to. But we know that for a Christian, the world is not meaningless, but it is meaningful. But here comes the question. There is an accusation from atheists that sometimes is uttered to believers, Christian believers and otherwise, but particularly Christians, saying, at least I have received this accusation myself many times, which is, of course it's nice to have a faith, and today we talk about faith and politics, right? So of course it's nice to have a faith, because then you have all the answers, right? So people that have a faith actually seek a refuge. I mean, that refuge is the complexity of the world, which is big and it's daunting. So you seek a refuge that gives you the answers, and then you are protected and safe, and then you can just go on with your life in a childish way. This would be the critique of Kant already, that, of course, would be understanding religion as a minority of age. And still in the 21st century, people who rely on religion and let themselves be inspired by it as people that are not enough grown up, people that are not ready to really face life as it is. And as it is means that there is no superior power that's going to fix things for you at the end or in between or at the beginning or whenever, right? In front of this critique that I think needs to be taken seriously of this atheism, I think from the Christian tradition and this notion of co-creation that I am developing now, the answer is that, wait a minute, in what sense does the Christian God give meaning to life? It is from above, it gives meaning, and what we believers have to do is to acknowledge this meaning, or it's something a bit more complicated, or a bit more interesting, or a bit more alive and dynamic. Going back to this example of Mary and what it can then represent for all of us, I continue with the 17th century theologian. She says, give light, let it be light. That is what we need for creation to happen. Creation is not a meaningless something. It is something that makes sense because this Christ, this Logos, would be the sustainer of the meaning of creation. And we know that from all the theology, that the world is exemplified in God, etc. But, and here is the originality of the theologian Maria of Agreta, this creation is not finished. in the act of creation that Genesis describes. This creation is started, and without the impulse of God, we would not be possible. It would not be possible to have a notion of creation. That's very clear. But this creation, it comes to its peak when Mary says, "Yes, let it be done. Let it be done in me, according to the word, and according to Maria de Agreda." There is here a word play that I can also not do in English, but in Spanish is dar a luz, la luz. But in English, you don't say give birth. It doesn't have a way of saying give light, right? You give birth, and it's give birth. But you sometimes it's adumbrate, or is that an English word? For giving birth? No.
It's quite an old-fashioned word.
But it is, right?
It only does exist a couple of hundred years ago.
Okay, I'm a bit old-fashioned, so no problem. But in that sense, it's a nice wordplay, but okay, in English it doesn't get. But it's the idea that you give the light to light, or you give birth to the light, so that this light is not yours, it's not Mary's, it's not ours, the meaning, it's not something that we, in that sense, produce, but it's something that cannot exist in the world unless we participate actively about this. So the Christian faith is not the faith that says, God is the actor and I'm the observer. That's not the Christian faith. The Christian faith says God is the impulse, and unless I become the actor, nothing will happen in the world. That's not a minor thing, I think. That's a notion of co-creation that I will develop more. So that, what Maria of Agreda, this theologian of the 17th century, is saying is that creation is not finished, and it became finished in Mary of Nazareth when she said yes. And when she said yes, it didn't mean, okay, yes, and then I'm a channel. Sometimes in the theology we use, at least in the Catholic context, a notion which is channel of mercy, right? To be a channel for the love of God. But this is not the image of Maria of Agreda. To be a channel, that's too little for her, because to become pregnant is a little bit different than to be a channel. You can be a channel of something, right, to get electricity here and pass it on. Okay, you are in the middle, but it's like a fleeting thing. To be pregnant is something quite different, right? To be pregnant, you need time, and you need to transform yourself to be able to give birth to this reality. And the biological pregnancies usually take 9 months. The theological pregnancies, they can take 9 years, or they can take more. Each person is different. But it means what I'm developing is faith cannot exist in a passive way. Faith cannot be passing on something that you've been told and you think, okay, it makes sense, okay, I pass it on, and I agree with this, I have faith. No. Faith, in that deep Christian sense, means I open up to a petition or to a request that God addresses to me directly and personally and says, do you want to become pregnant with me? That is what I'm trying to be talking about in this first part. And this, I can, for the last time or again, quote this theologian of the 17th century, because she explains all this about Mary and says that Mary paused, that she thought, that she considered what was happening, and that she freely opened up her subjectivity to that request. But when she finishes her chapters, it's interesting that she uses as a literary device that at the end of her chapter, the literary character of Mary of Nazareth, her name is Mary of Agreda, right? This theologian. But then comes Mary of Nazareth at the end of the chapter and makes the critique of the chapter to her, right? Says, okay, that was good. Well, not very good. And that's an interesting literary device. Actually, the school of the 17th century is well known in literature for the emergence, the appearance of feminine subjectivity that happens in literature in different trends in England, also very important. And then it's interesting that this author in Spain, in the Counter-Reformation, is also using that or doing that. So then comes Mary of Nazareth at the end of the chapter and says, okay, that chapter was quite good, huh? You did quite well. But you made a mistake. And the mistake, says Mary of Nazareth, is that you talked about all this that it happened between the angel and myself and God and myself. You talked about this as if that were only concerning me. And you are right in the sense that this biological birth and everything, that happened to me. But it would make no sense whatsoever, this incarnation, such a central notion of the Christian faith, it would be meaningless if you don't understand that what God wants to do with you is exactly the same. Not in a biological way, but that this becoming pregnant, not only addressing the women that can be pregnant, but addressing the women and the men. It's a feminine metaphor that is a good metaphor for faith, for men and for women, according to this theologian. So to each of us is addressed this request from God, do you want to become pregnant? But if you say yes, this is a transformation. This is not something that you can be actually passing on and remaining who you are or how you are. A pregnancy has danger. Sometimes you die in the process, right? And for sure, you're going to be changing in a very meaningful way. And what's most important is what you're going to be giving birth to, giving out or giving away or giving, passing on or letting be born in the world. It's, of course, it cannot be a copy of anything else. It has to be something essentially personal, essentially original, something that this coming together of the Spirit of God with yourself is going to take a form in the world that it's only yours and that cannot be copied from somebody else. So you have to be daring. You have to be ready to risk. You have to be ready to start a new path. You have to be ready to take risks. And that's part of it. And that's why I think in front of this easy critique of certain atheism that says, okay, you have all the solution. Well, I think from the Christian perspective, it can be answered. Wait a minute and let me talk to you about co-creation. What it means for me to be a believer is not that I got the solution and I know everything and I just have to carry it on. It means really taking a risk. It means really opening up to a radical adventure of entering in a personal communication with God and letting that to challenge in me what I really need to do with my life and what I really need to do in the world. Taking responsibility in a very direct, radical, and clear way for my own life and for also the life around me. And doing that, aware that if I don't do it, my life and the surrounding life, in the measure that it's available to me, will not have meaning, will be meaningless, will be absurd. That, I believe, and we can discuss in the discussion, is the radicality of what we are talking about when we talk about Christian co-creation or Christian meaning of the world. The Christian God does not impose a meaning on the world. It proposes. And this, what it proposes, is also not an already set, finished meaning. Because this incarnation means that this idea of love, that we know God is about love, but what it means to love, that's not that easy. I don't find that in any manual. I can say, yes, of course I know the solution. Have to love. Okay, what does it mean? What does it mean for me to love? Should I have come today to give this talk? Should I have stayed? Should I have been talking or as I'm doing? Or should I have changed this? Where is it that I find this solution? I don't find it anywhere as a believer. I don't just open the Bible and it comes to me what I have to do. I don't believe in this. I believe in acknowledging my own responsibility in a more, even more radical way than I would be doing were I not a believer. Because at least the non-believers that I know, they also are acknowledging their own limits in the sense of saying there are moments in life where you cannot keep going with this sense of loving. You have to just retreat to some kind of, right? That's enough, right? There is a limit in what you can be called to do in the world. And I think, at least that's what I would like to think, that my own faith puts me in a position where I don't see myself with this possibility of saying, okay, enough. Yet I close and I say, love is not anymore my guide. Now it's going to be force. Now I'm going to try to just have things my own way. I don't think my faith allows me to do that. And that's why I don't think my faith is a protection or a safe haven or a safe retreat or a place to hide. On the contrary, I see my faith as being something not violent and something very deeply inspiring, but something not that easy, right? Something that calls us, if we take it seriously, to the forefront. And forefront doesn't mean political for everybody, it means for each person. Each person precisely has to decide, right, what it means for me to take seriously this request of God, what it means for me to pray in a way that makes myself aware of this notion of theotokos, of this notion of co-creation, of this notion that the meaning of the world is something that God wants me to be a part of, and that I have a responsibility in that. This I bring together with this notion of creation. Maybe are you familiar with the notion of the Jewish tradition, the Jewish rabbinic tradition of the medieval times? Speak about Tzimtzum. Is that familiar to any of you? Tzimtzum, that would be with T, well, okay, Tzimtzum, T-Z-Z. That's the notion of the Kabbalah, the Jewish Kabbalah. And an author of the 20th century, Simone Weil, this philosopher, also mystic and socially engaged, she took it and developed it also. Tzimtzum means, how do we imagine the creation of the world? Do we imagine that as an expansion of God, right? We could think, okay, here's God, and then God, at a given moment, there is no time in God, but we don't have other words, right, to talk about this. So at a given moment, God thinks, okay, I decide freely to do creation, right? And then God kind of expands into something else, which we call creation. Well, that makes no sense metaphysically, because there is no notion of a beyond God, right? The notion of God, if you want to use this notion, is a notion that precludes the idea of a beyond from God. It's like God is here and then makes something beyond that cannot be thought of. The idea of the tzimtzum of this rabbinic theology is that in order to create the world and to create it as the Christian idea is, and also the Jewish, of course, in this sense, as not a part of God, because we could say, okay, no problem, you cannot create or have a notion of creation beyond God, but you can have it within, right? And there are many, not only Christian, but other spiritualities that think we are part of God. We are in God. Of course, we are not beyond God. God is everything, God is everywhere, and we are like in God, and we are there. How is that? Embraced, right? Welcomed by God and nurtured and exactly embraced and protected by God. Okay, that's another way to look at it, and it seems that Paul, when it says, in God we are and live and everything, so it's making reference to this. But the Christian tradition is very clear in setting a clear, a real difference between the world and God, in the sense that the world, the creation, is not a piece of God, it's not a part of God. It's really has a dignity of its own, and it has an alterity, that's a very important word for politics also, an alterity, a true diversity vis-a-vis God. That Thomas von Aquinas, in the 13th century, had already written a chapter in his Summa Theologica question that the title is, how many goods there are? And that metaphysically and philosophically seems a question that can only be answered with only one, right? God is the goodness, and that's all good is participating of this good. But Thomas answers how good there are, and he says there are many, because the good of a human person is not to become God, like God. The alterity is not something that is suboptimal, and the reality of optimal things, the best, the highest, the strongest, the mightiest, is unity. That's not what the idea of Trinity represents. It's a very challenging, philosophically, until today, a challenging idea that says the last word, the last reality, the last thing, the ultimate reference, is not only unity, but it's unity in diversity. The diversity, the multiplicity in the sense of difference, the alterity, is not suboptimal. In the pre-Socratic philosophers, there was always a tendency to find a convergence point, right? A reference point that, as you know, the pre-Socratics thought, some of them it was water, others it's fire, it is air. There are different names, but the idea is the multiplicity that's obvious in the world. We look around and we see different things, right? Here's this tape, and then the lantern or whatever, the chair, and it's obvious that the differences in the world are obvious. But for the hegemonic or the main part of the Western philosophy and also in the East, there was a perception that this apparent multiplicity was, as the name apparent indicates, not the last wisdom. That the true wisdom meant to be able to perceive underneath or above this multiplicity, the unity. But the problem with that is that, as I said, the multiplicity or the diversity then becomes suboptimal, and we postulate a unity that supposedly is the ultimate truth. Of course, that's not the only way to think about philosophy. Already in the classical Greek philosophy, we know about Parmenides, that thought like that, that the unity was the real truth and the real God. But we had Heraclitus also, and Heraclitus thought, come on, what's this construct of unity beyond diversity? Be clear, be real, right? You look around, there is diversity, and that's what there is. And accept that that's what there is. And that's not too bad. What's the problem with diversity, right? So that's, of course, today many philosophies go in this direction, but that's also not something new. Already in the classical period, some philosophers were looking at the world and thinking diversity is the ultimate word. And others, no, unity is the ultimate word. And in between this tension between unity and diversity comes this idea of the Trinity, this idea of the Christian God that says unity and diversity are actually inseparable. They imply each other. It's not that we have to decide whether the plurality is ultimate or the unity is ultimate, but it's a notion of diversity without which we cannot have a notion of unity. Am I doing okay? Are we okay? Because here I would like to give an example from biology to illustrate what that means, right? We could have the example of two, how do we say in English, drops of water, drops. Two drops of water, in Spanish we say, iguales como dos gotas de agua, if I say whether in English you say that, like, they are exactly like two drops of water, as an example of equality, right? So two drops of water, precisely because they are so equal, and today there are some research that indicates that also they are not so equal, because the molecules of water have also very interesting nuances, but I don't go into that now. So let's assume that two drops of water are equal, but only differentiated because they occupy different places in space, or maybe one is bigger than the other, right? A quantitative difference. Precisely because they are so equal to each other, the only unity possible between two drops of water is one of greater mass. Right? They can come together and make a bigger drop. Okay, so that's a unity of sorts. But it's such a weak unity that at any point you can separate that back. And you get again the two drops of water. Because of this great unity, because of this great similarity, you can have the two drops together, and the unity is so weak that you can have them separated again and get again what you had at the beginning. If we think now of a more complex organism, not two drops of water, but let's think about a cat. If you have a cat, of course the different parts of the cat, they are not equal to each other. We know all cells have the same chromosomic information, but they differentiate differently. So you have the eye of the cat and you have the tail of the cat, and they look quite different to each other. Precisely because of this diversity, if you take a cat and cut it in the middle, you don't get two cats. The unity of this diversified, innerly diversified organism is stronger now, or precisely because of its differentiation in biology. So it's not that the greater similarity builds up a stronger unity. That's not the case in biology, and also I would claim in politics or in Christian communities or in the family or in a couple even. The greater similarity is not the condition or the precondition for a greater unity. The greater diversity is. The greater the diversity, the stronger the potential unity, but of course also the stronger the potential division. Thomas, also in the 13th century, said, the contrary of unity is not diversity. The contrary of unity is not diversity. The contrary of unity is division. That's another thing. If because I am not like you, I say I don't want to have anything to do with you, of course that's against unity, that's division, right? But it's not the case precisely that if I find that you are different than me, I might be more attracted to you, might be more ready to say, okay, let's have a conversation here, because you have something to say that I don't know about. But if you were so similar to me as to be like two drops of water, it would be like, okay, what's the point here? Am I clear with this idea? But that's something that I think has political consequences, and has political consequences for how we think what's ideal. When I entered the monastery, I entered in 97, and I talked to the abbess. I'm part of a Benedictine monastery. And at that time I was in the United States as a physician, working in hospitals, and I studied theology there too, and then I entered the monastery in 97. And the abbess said, okay, Teresa, I would like to ask you, what is your goal in these first months in the monastery? We call that the postulantate, and the postulant year. It's 1 year that we are part of the monastery, but still you don't dress as a nun, and you are there living, sharing the life, but like, learning whether that can be something for you or not. And the community is also learning whether you could be a member or not, right? So during this year, she said, what do you think is your goal? And I said, okay, I think my goal is to accommodate myself to the ways of the house, right? How things are done here, to just learn to adapt myself. And she said, oh, what a pity. What do you mean, what a pity? Have I not said an obvious thing? She said, yes, I understand what you mean, and of course I appreciate that. But you know what? Because you come from the United States and you're a physician and you have a profile that's very different from the other sisters that are here up to now. Now it's not anymore the case because since 1997 many more have entered that are also very diverse. But at that time it was true what she told me. She said, so I was hoping that you could help me realize what is my dream for the community. And my dream for the community is not that as we keep living together, we become every time more homogeneous with each other, or more alike, or more of one piece, right? More like we see things in the same or similar way. That's not my dream. My dream for our community is that as we move into a deeper faith and into a deeper relationship with God, we become more different from each other. We become more original. We become more able to express something that's unique in each person. I thought, that's interesting. And that's why when I had the chance, I did my doctoral dissertation in theology about the Trinity, and precisely about what it has meant in the history of theology, but also in its political consequences, to think the ultimate reality of a meaningful world as a unity in diversity, as a unity that's not above, not an inch, not a nothing, not a iota, or not a quantum leap, or nothing above diversity. But it's something intrinsically linked to diversity, that you cannot think the one without the other. That means also that in God, in the Christian God, thought out as the Trinity, celebrated and worshipped as the Trinity, in the Christian God there is a no. And the no is the Father is not the Son, and it's not the Spirit. The Spirit is not, I like that, because all critical thinking without no, what would we do? Huh? So that in God there is a no. I think that's very liberating. That's something good that we have to remember. So that the thing is not about this type of ultimate goal of converging, and of course you have to have the fights and the differences, and you have to negotiate, and you have to just give place for the others, but then finally what? Where is it that we are going? What is it that we imagine at the end? I would like to also draw another example from the Bible. This is the Babel Tower in Genesis 11. Comes it, this a story where it says the people, that's not yet the Israelites, because Abraham comes in chapter 12. So in chapter 11 we have this humanity being created by God, and actually being all sharing the same language, that's what the narrative says, and also sharing the same project. Everybody is working towards a common project, and that's building a tower, right? And they are one project, all united, one language. That's wonderful, right? There is a problem that God looks and says, I don't like this. And then thinks, how can I undo this, right? How can I disturb this thing that I don't like? And then it sends the linguistic diversity. So it sends the different languages so that these people start speaking different languages so they don't understand each other, and then it's impossible for them to build one project. And that's in the reality what happens, so it's dispersion. And you might think this is a terrorist God, right? What is this for a purpose? Why did God want to destroy this possibility of working together so nicely? Well, because I don't think God is against unity and wanted to destroy unity. But I think strongly, and I am convinced strongly, that God is against uniformity. That's different. One thing is unity, and as I'm trying to elaborate here, unity has to do with diversity. Necessarily, the greater the diversity, the greater the unity, and never the other way. But uniformity is something very different. That has to do with military action, and that has to do with empire, and that has to do, sorry to say, with globalization, right? We speak about globalization, and here at the London Economics School, I'm sure you talk a lot about it, but I'm talking about the reality of a uniformizing. I was in Wien, also invited by the university to give a talk last week, and I was appalled by the center of Wien. I had been in Wien 20 years ago, and I remember that the street around the Stephanus Dome was very nice to walk to, and that it was like I couldn't tell if I was in Los Angeles, I was in Wien, or where I was. All the big businesses, the same ones, all throughout the streets, and everything, like a type of uniformizing that was very obvious for me to see. So I don't like that. I think we are going the wrong direction. It's like we are building with this process of globalization the way it's going. Of course, I'm in favor of becoming an interdependent world and having the more as possible relationship with each other, of course, but not like in Genesis 11, right? I would rather have it like in Acts of the Apostles 2, which is the Pentecost scene. In the Pentecost scene, the difference is that everybody is talking his or her own language. And now you can understand why in the presentation I was talking as an advocate for Catalan nationalism or independence, right? Of course, I don't defend a sense of, oh, the Catalans are a special people and they need to have their special place to do their special thing. It makes no sense for me, right? As a Christian, I believe, of course, that everybody is made in the image of God and that everybody is my sister, my brother, potentially, and that I have a claim and I have a responsibility and I have a relationship for everybody. That's how I think in terms of humanity. But that is the frame, and now it comes, how is this to be worked? So from the diversity. I don't see it's a better way to try to build up Esperanto, right? A type of language that is the same for everybody, and try to build a government that is the same for everybody, and try to build like a constituency that's the same for everybody, and then we'll be going in the right track. That's scary. That I really don't like. I think it's we have to foster the diversity, not to foster the division. I don't want division. But to foster the diversity, it means to find the political ways, and in our case, maybe in Catalonia at this moment, it would be better for us to have this independence to be able then to link maybe back to Spain or the Spanish republics. I don't know what can happen there, back to Europe or within Europe or within the Mediterranean. There are many options. And of course, I want my country to be linked to others, but not in a subservient way, not in a way that seems to break or to stultify or to quench diversity, right? To stop diversity. Sometimes they have come into some web pages where they have a counter, like you come into these ecological web pages or web pages about ecological activism. You come in and then you see, they tell you, here is a counter, and as you are reading this page, so many species are lost in the world. I don't know if you've come, it's very scary to go, it's very sad for me, right? Because you feel like, what do you mean? I've been reading this page 5 minutes and 10 species less of whatever animals, or that's, of course, maybe applying to some microbes from some obscure cave somewhere, but nevertheless, it's sad for me to think that this is happening, that we are destroying the diversity, the biodiversity. So if it is sad for me to think of biodiversity as something that's being diminished, of course it's sad for me to think of cultural diversity as something that's being diminished. And I don't like to contribute to that. On the other hand, I'm also not in favor of considering languages or cultures like something to be preserved in a museum, right? I don't want the Catalan language to come into a museum and then I want to go there, put it under a crystal and then take the dust away every day as if it were like a mummy to preserve or something. No, I understand languages and cultures are alive and they are dynamic and they have to be moving. And if Latin and so many great languages of the past have disappeared, of course, Catalan and English and whatever else might disappear in the future, and I don't have a problem with that. But I have a problem with us organizing politically in a way that does not foster diversity. And I would try to, in my little, whatever it is, world of action or possibilities, to contribute in the church, in theology, but also in politics, if I can, or in the social life, to contribute. How is it that we can not only tolerate diversity, because we talk about this today, right? Okay, of course, we cannot force other people to convert. We cannot force other people to think like we do. We cannot force, so we have to tolerate. No, that's not exactly what I'm talking about, right? Toleration is like a minor key, and I want to play in a major key. That's fostering and this celebrating. And this is really looking at the diversity and looking at the difference as something precious, as something that we have to acknowledge, foster, cultivate, and care for. Here I can quote also the definition of freedom of Rosa Luxemburg, the founder of the Communist Party in Germany, which said, freedom, we have a notion of freedom today that's usually very self-centered, right? Freedom as this possibility to do in the world what I would like to, etc. Okay, Rosa Luxemburg said, freedom is always freedom of the one who thinks differently. That's quite an interesting definition, I think, for freedom. It's like I cannot measure my own degree of freedom, of inner freedom, The best way to measure it is, how do I relate to you in case you think differently than me? Because if you think the same, you are not a good opportunity for me to measure my degree of freedom. So if I cannot tolerate that you think different, it's because you think different, you are different, you express yourself different, I just go away from you. That means that I am not innerly free, and I am not somebody able to participate in this common building of a sense of the world. I'm somebody that probably is acting out of fear, right? Fear to be challenged, fear to be contradicted, that I'm wrong, fear to be crushed by you that are different. This fear that we have seen in the, I think, United Kingdom voting on these European elections, also in France, and, well, in Spain things have gone different, but I'm convinced that in a few months things can change again. I'm all for the dynamic, right? So my point is not to interpret these results in a everlasting way, but to do that in a dynamic way, right? To see how easy it is for people to retreat into this fearful uniformity politics and to try to find a similar constituency where to feel safe. And I think, as I said at the beginning, contrary to some of the critiques of contemporary atheists, to have a faith, for me, to have the Christian faith, has nothing to do with a retreat in a safe heaven. It's a propulsion. It's like an impulse. It's like, right, a gentle but consistent wind of the spirit that's saying, no, a little bit more. It's like, okay, I have enough. Let me rest now. It's like, okay, tomorrow, yeah? Today, just push without the stress, hopefully, but with this sense of mission in the best possible way, not to go to convert other people, but to have a responsibility, that sense of responsibility. How are we doing with time? Because I wanted to say little... Oh, that I went too much. Huh? So only very briefly, because briefly about Tsim Tsum and Pericores, and then we have the dialogue, because Tsim Tsum I have mentioned already, but I would like to make the point more clearly. This notion of creation, as I said, it's not an expansion. It doesn't make metaphysical sense to conceptuate creation as an expansion, but it's also not enough to think that the world is within God as a part of God, as meaning God is everywhere. The radicality of the Tsim Tsum notion is that God is ready enough to engage in an alterity relationship with the world, that before creation, God actually retracted. It's not an expansion, creation of God, because, as I said, it doesn't make sense. God is already big enough, right? It's not more expansion. But it is a retraction. It's like God is making place for you to be not God. That's the importance of alterity. So God is saying, I hear, I'm going to give up the possibility, and that is creation, and that's the light of creation. I'm going to give up the possibility for something to exist that it is not God. But that not for lack of love or lack of concern. On the contrary, it's like so that this something can be, a very important word in faith and in politics, can be free. What is freedom? If I am a part of God, whether I like it or not. Oh, how wonderful. Really? Yes, but something is missing here, right? That if God can do whatever God wants, and what is the sense of freedom, of radical freedom, that I think has to be at the core of politics and at the core of faith. It's like this radical cry of Jesus on the cross, that it's not like solving things at the last moment. What does it mean that this is taken seriously? What does it mean that God dares to open up a space where something that is not God, of course, is sustained by God. Of course, in that sense, I can subscribe what Paul says. In God we are, and we live, and we breathe, and everything. But not in the sense that God controls us, or God occupies our space. God has retreated. And has retreated, and it's holding that space that is not God. Of course, it's God holding that space. So in that sense, we are a gift from God, and we are dependent and creatures and everything. But what God has done is to open up a space for us to exist, really, and saying no to God, if we want to say no. But of course, God is expecting that we say, yes, come to this space where you are not, because you gave it to me. And now that's my space, and I say, come. Maranatha, right? This cry in Advent, what we say before the Christmas, that we say, God, come. And if I don't say, God, come, God will not come. That's the point, with co-creation and Mary of Agreda and everything that I've explained. That's how serious that is. And if, for example, in Revelation, the book of Revelation says, I am at the door and I'm knocking. If you open the door, I will come in and then I will eat with you. And if you don't open the door, I won't come in. That's not only theory and biblical quotes and theology. This is the reality. Have you not experienced that? That it's, you can really live a life where God is not present. And we can socially also and politically organize in a way that God is... Where is the love of God and the redemption? Oh, yes, we are redeemed. Oh, really? How many people are dying every day? 26,000 children dying from hunger every day. In Spain, 100 families being evicted from the home every day. At the peak of it, when maybe in the news here in the United Kingdom, maybe that was also published, it was 500 families being evicted every day. Now it's only 100 families being evicted. When they have a small children, the children are taking them from them because children cannot live in the streets, right? And in Spain, it's a country in Europe that has the greatest number of apartments without occupying, empty apartments. The majority of them, 3 million of them, are property of the banks that just clausulate them, stop them, and those banks have received the money that the European Union, the central bank, gave to the Spanish government. The Spanish government gave to these banks to savage them. And now they close the houses and send the people to this. It's too absurd. It's too much, right? To be thinking, yes, but somehow God makes sense of it. I don't believe that for a minute, right? I think God is saying, what are you doing, right, with this? I mean, call me in. I'm ready to help and to inspire, but I cannot come in if you don't call me. And you cannot call me in a general way. I cannot call in for you or for you. We have to do each of us to call and not, I did it 10 years ago and since then I'm okay. No, that's a constant thing, constantly. That's a deciding whether you want to live inspired by this sense of justice and sense of love, or you want to say yes tomorrow, but today let me take care of some other things, right? So that was the idea of Tzimtzum as a radical freeing of space sustained by God, where something can happen that is not God, but God is expecting that we say, come. And this God could do in the creation, because that's exactly how God is in God's self. And this is the Trinity, and that's the perichoresis. Perichoresis, very briefly, is a Greek term that has a prefix, peri, that means around, and has a root, choreo, that in English we still have the word choreography. You have that word, right? So it's like writing with the body in the space. Choreo means space. So choreography is like writing, graphy, but in the space. And that's a dance, right? So choreo means a space. Peri means around. So the Trinity, the technical term for the Trinity, perichoresis, it means that in the Trinitarian love, if I am to love, I take an example, to love you is not as much the erotic metaphor that we can also use, which is I want you to come in me and I want to come in you. That's the Song of Songs uses that language, and I don't see a problem also to use it. But the more technical term for the Trinitarian love, for God who is love, is perichoresis. That means if I love you, what I do is to make space, choreo, peri, around you. I just make a space. Make a space so that you can be whatever you want to be. That's to love. If somebody does that to you, I'm sure you're going to feel loved in a very authentic way. If somebody wants you in, that can be love, but also can be violence. Somebody can want you, right, to come into you, and that's it for women, very clear with rape, but not only for women. You can be desired in that way that has nothing to do with love. Has to do with this sense of property even, right? But I cannot imagine somebody making a space around me so that I use the space as I see fit as something else but love. That's perichoresis. And that is what I would like to see happening in myself, but also in religious communities, but also in politics. Perichoretic politics, perichoretic communities, perichoretic couples, perichoretic families. So people inspired by this idea of making space for the other person, which is what the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit do to each other. In the Gospel, it's very interesting, for me it's amusing, to see how Jesus says, the Father, the Father, the Father. No, everything has told me the Father, I only do what the Father, the Father. Okay, so you can say, okay, now let's look at the Father. And the Father says, listen to my Son. And like, come on, now listen to the Son. The Father, and the Father says the Son. And you seem that you, who is the boss, right? What is the thing that really is going to give us the solution? Well, isn't the solution, so to speak, precisely this realizing that there has to be a dialogue of freedom and love. And dialogue of freedom of love means, here we have this panel that Reverend Walters told me it was about the desert, right? So this sense of pilgrim the sense of walking, the sense that the classical Latin theology calls homo viator, of the way, on the way, right? It's not a definitive thing. How can we have a God that's Trinitarian, that's a dance, that's perichoretic, that's dynamic, and then a thinking of already finished, established, and controlled reality? We need to think the reality as something open, but not open in whatever direction. Open in the direction of reciprocal freedom and love. Thank you.
I can't tell you how good it is to have some theology at the LSE. Please do stay and we'll set up a department. Very rich. You took us from Ephesus to the European elections, and I'm sure in the discussion we'll perhaps draw out some more of the implications of what you've been saying. So please, let's open to the floor. Are you happy to remain standing?
I'm okay.
Yeah, yes. Great. There was a hand. Yes.
I'm Spanish. And I've also a PhD student here in the Department of Anthropology, and I did my research with Anglican sisters in the Solomon Islands.
So before I went which island?
Solomon Islands.
You told me yes.
So before I went to the Solomon Islands and I lived with sisters, I experienced Catholicism in a way that I didn't like, you know. And then I went to the Solomon Islands and experienced religion in a different way. But when I talk with my sisters, I just explain to them that I can't really experience the same religion back in Spain that I do with them. Mm-hmm. So, and they explain here religion in a different way, you know. So I was just wondering, like, how do you think Spanish people understand religion in Spain, you know, and how that relates with historical background that we have in Spain with, mm-hmm. you know, Francism and the Catholic Church. And, that's the first question. And the second one is, I can see, you know, like, how did you explain the theological notion of procreation and how this collaboration between God and people, or between people mm-hmm. in earth, you know, or...
Yes.
You know, relates. And I can see how it is in your project. But at the same time, like, you have been criticized for, you know, like, this is like what I have read in the news, you know, like, for putting a Catholic project into the Catalonia mm-hmm. project, mm-hmm. which I didn't share it. But I think it's like, are we ready to have, you know, theological discussion in, mm-hmm. you know, let's say Catalonia or Spain? You know, like, are we mm-hmm. ready to have?
Okay. So the first question is about this, whether the faith in Spain is different, or religion is different in Spain, that you can, and how?
How do you think that people see the Catholicism in Spain?
So that's, for me, the Catholicism, like Christianity in general, and I'll say something specific about Spain, but first let me say that this different takes on how to interpret the faith, I don't think this is something special of Spain, special of the 21st century, and that we today lack diversity and speak like this. That is already in the gospel, right? You have in the gospel Jesus going to the cross and turns the head and says, what are we really talking about? The disciples are talking about who is going to be most important in the kingdom of heaven, right? So from the beginning, there is this sense of somebody, in this case is Jesus, and some of the followers, like, thinking on that way, that what's happening has a meaning beyond my personal interest, and some people trying to instrumentalize religion for a personal fear or a personal project or something. So this, it's not a scandal for me, it's there from the beginning. So it's something that it's there in Spain, and of course, you are right, during the Franco, the fascist dictatorship, 40 years in Spain, that was a shame that the institutional church, with very honorable exceptions, but they were killed and some were in exile, so in the 40 years, with no exception, because they had been expelled, was actually backing up a criminal dictatorship. A fascist, that's the case, right? And so Franco the dictator came bajo palio, that means like the host was carried in the processions, so that thus was carried the dictator, as a symbol that he was a defender of the faith. So this is appalling, and this we need to pay or to exonerate that still for some years, right, to come. So it's very comprehensible to me that some of the sons and daughters of these fighters of the Spanish Civil War, they just want nothing to do with nuns and with somebody that has to do with the church, right? So that I understand. But at the same time, there are many people that are ready to break that and to breach that. But of course not to breach to a discourse of the faith that looks like the old one, right? That but if somebody, like it is my case, but not only me, there are other people that talk of faith and does it not as a strategy, but honestly, that's how I live it. I was not born a Catholic. Better said, yes, in the family, but I never, my family was telling me as I was a child, oh, the church, you have to mistrust the church, it's out there for politics and it's trying to just control people. And so I grew like that. I did First Communion and I was baptized, but I never had a faith experience. I never went to the church, only for weddings, right? But with my family, we came always late and my father was smoking in the back and we were like coming out and it's not ready. No, it's not that I have a remembrance of being like an altar and something there, but it could have been that with 5, 6, 7, or 8 years I could have been drawn by some beauty or something, but I was not, right? I was just not understanding what's going on and just enjoying the party, right? Until I was 15. When I was 15 years old, I read for the first time the Gospels and I was taken by that text. Why? I cannot explain. I can only give witness that that's what happened. I read that and I was drawn to it. And I started reading then books of theology, but the first book of theology that I read was Jesus Christ, the Liberator by Leonardo Boff, Liberation Theology. So for me, Liberation Theology is theology. Of course, after I've studied theology, I have my doctoral degree, and I can tell you I'm aware of other current in theology. But that's my own story. So how I talk, it comes from my own biography. And I can tell you that in Spain, many people are ready for this kind of talk, because many people up to today, and even in the haste of the Civil War, many people read the Gospels and they like that. They think this Jesus person is somebody that deserves respect, a deep one, right? And many revolutionaries, and starting with Che Guevara, and whatever, they just think this Jesus figure has been manipulated by the church, but it's one of them, in a way, right? So that, I think, is very important, because I agree with that. So that would be... And then you said the second question, which...
Yeah, you were ready to have a theological discussion.
Okay, so I think I'm not trying to have a theological... I mean, today, yes, because of the invitation, but usually I'm not going in politics to say, let's talk about the Bible. I take examples of the Bible, because that's how I talk, right? But I'm not trying to inspire any kind of theocracy, right? Even if I like so much the gospel, I do not want a politics that's under the gospel or that's baptized or that it has the imprint of the church or anything like that. But I do want a politics where everyone, also included me and whoever else, can participate with its diversity. I don't want to just blunt my own motivation for engaging politically in the sake of a common denominator that's then blend and it's like irrelevant and it's similar to everybody. No, I'm there because of the human rights. Well, I'm not against human rights, but I'm not there because of the human rights. I'm there because of perichoresis and co-creation, and this is my language, right? But I don't need for you to use that language, right? You can come and say, I'm here because of Rosa Luxemburg and whatever. Oh, welcome. Very nice. Somebody else can be here and then name some revolutionaries of the Chinese culture that I have no clue about. So I like that. I think that's the world I would like to see happening. So, no, we are not ready for a theological discussion, and we don't need a theological discussion. What we need is now in Spain, very urgently, it's a movement of grassroots able to unite all this dissatisfaction that is generalized and it's majoritarian. More than 50% of the population want a change, of course, with the present politics. Why is it not happening? It's because we are not united. We are fragmented, and we go to the elections, and we don't win. So that's what I'm trying to contribute to.
Thank you.
Yes.
Hello. Thank you very much.
Yes.
Thank you very much. I'm Valentin, and I wanted to ask you about the Catalan conflict, because you said that your commitment to Catalan independence originates from a desire to protect diversity.
Yes.
How do you explain your political commitment to the Balear Islands and the Valencian country, which are experiencing greater cultural misery than Catalonia under Spanish influence? And how do you explain that, like, in Catalan independence, like, whenever, like, people talk about the Catalan countries is because, like, oh yeah, poor Valencians, or yeah, they're still not quite there. It's like patronizing or indifferent, or like neglecting.
Okay, so for those of you who are not right from the area, that's in current Spain, there are three so-called autonomous regions that share a language, which is this Catalan or Valencian, or we are not going to discuss about the name of the language, but it's one language that it's spoken, or it's the traditional language in the Balearic Islands, Mallorca, Menorca, Ibiza, Formentera, Cabrera, and also in Valencia and also in Catalonia, right? So there are, but they are administratively not recognized as any kind of unity by the current Spanish political framework, but they are like Valencia. And Catalonia would be like Catalonia and Andalusia or Catalonia and Basque Country, so they are different autonomies within the greater Spain. But we share a language, and there is a project called, he said, Catalan Countries, Països Catalans, that is an idea of this unity, of all this linguistic unity in a political entity, right? Okay, so how I see the thing is this is a project that I can only see in the future being realized if the people in Valencia want it, if the people in Baleares want it. I don't see a space, political space, for a movement that starts in Catalonia to go to Valencia and try to be present in Valencia as telling the Valencian people what would be best to do. We've been called by some people, right? I mean Procés Constituent, the political movement I'm part of, in Baleares, many people said, come here and start here assemblies for Procés Constituent. And other people said, come to Valencia and do this here. And we've discussed that in Procés Constituent. And what we have answered is, if you start something, and you don't need to be a majority to start, you can start with 10 people. And we'll be supporting that, of course, because we want to support all that fosters diversity in that open way that I'm talking about. But the starting point cannot be coming from Catalonia, because I don't see a future for that. Also, we are not such a big thing that can do that. We are small and we have many challenges. But I think it's not only out of lack of resources, which is true also, but I think it's because of the meaningfulness of a political movement that advocates radical democracy, and it says, well, that has to come from above. From below, right? And of course, it's not has to come and we are going to just watch it from outside. If it comes, and we are going to be linking and just favoring as much as possible this relationship. But I don't see it starting outside of it. Does it make sense?
But like, how would you talk about those who think that like misery, like cultural misery in Malacan country and other islands has to come? Has been like the price of like Catalonia to have their own identity within Spain. Like, how do you like those who think that it's like something relational and that anti-Catalanism in Valencia is like an outcome of like, so ones go up and the price to pay is that the others go down.
Okay, so I can see that as manipulated by the central government in a way, or by some of the local governments too, but of course that wouldn't be what Procés Constituent is benefiting from or liking, because this is exactly the contrary of what I said, right? This idea that diversity is a threat and that you have to just pit one against the other, this is all contrary to my way of being inspired in politics, but I acknowledge what you mean, and for those who don't know about it, it's like this idea of, in Valencia, saying that the Catalans are out there to kind of colonize Valencia again and to try to make them lose even their own language called Valenciano and call it Catalan, and all this I am aware of, and it's a type of politics that's very remote from mine, but I don't see that it can be challenged in any other way than from the bottom in Valencia itself. And then, yes, I'll be there coming to give a talk and everything that you want.
Thank you. There's somebody here, and then we'll go to the front of the back, and then we'll come down to the front here. Okay.
Thank you very much for the talk. I have two questions. One is just a small technical. I really like the term pericorrese, but how is it usually used for? I haven't heard it before.
Okay, it's a technical term in the Trinity. So if you open a book on the Trinity, that's classical, right? So it would be pericorrese. That is a name to express the relationship of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. And it's used precisely to avoid the hierarchy, right? The pyramid of power in the Trinity. So to avoid the idea that the Trinity looks a little bit like the old Plotinian, Neoplatonic deity, which was the three hypostases, that's in the 3rd century after Christ, which was this idea that there is a supreme good that comes from Plato already, right? And as I said, that is hegemonic, right? That the thinking, you think about the world and you think, not everybody, but most people think there has to be like a supreme good, right? And that's the highest point. But then, okay, this supreme good, in the Platonic sense and still today, is conceptualized as utterly removed from everything, utterly majestic, utterly quiet, still, sovereign. There, that's the supreme good. And then the demiurge, that's Platonic language, is the creator of the world. Because this one works a little bit, so that doesn't befit the majesty of the highest good. So the highest good sends the demiurge, right? And the demiurge is still God in Platonic sense, but it's just a minor God because it just moves. And you know, for these classical philosophies, it's the stillness is very good. Huh? So this good makes, but there is still a third one in this Neoplatonic thought, which is, okay, the demiurge made the world, and that comes in Timaeus, this dialogue from Plato, but it's not enough to make the world. You have to be also, recognize that in the world there is a principle of unity, right? That's called the spirit of the world. So that's the third hypostatic principle of the Platonic religion. But those three are clearly hierarchical, right? The first, the second, and the third. There is a subordination. At the beginning, the first centuries of the church, there was a very hard work to break this. And I think up to today, we have not gotten it, what it means. We have gotten it theoretically in a dogmatic formula. But in the tat, in the reality, we still have a long way to go, right? But at the beginning, so that you see how difficult that was, at the beginning it was, okay, we get it. Father, Son, Holy Spirit. The Father is the bishop, the Son is the priest, and the Holy Spirit is the deacon. And women can only be deacons. That was at the beginning, right? The Didache speaks like this, some of these early works. They had this type of symbolic language for the Trinity, that the Father was like the bishop, so the one who has the greater command, the one who has the last word. And the priest, then it's like the Son, which is a little bit less than the Father, and then the Holy Spirit even less. So to break this, the name perichoresis, the first time we find it in the history of theology, is not as a noun, perichoresis is as a verb, perichoreo, and that's in the work of Gregory of Nazianzus. That's the 4th century. And the second time that comes, very importantly applied to the Trinity, is in the works of Maximus the Confessor. And that's in the 7th century. And they're in a full understanding of what it is. And it remains to today the technical word in the Greek church. In the Latin, circumincessio, that's Latin word, is used instead of, but the perichoresis is used by many current theologians.
Thank you. And my second question is... A brief question. In terms of how to apply this, for example, in the case of evicted families, how would you... Where would you place the solution? Is it in the bankers or is it in the people who should rise?
Yes, well, for me it's very clear. This is. There are some things difficult, and I already talked not of a simplified world, and we just know the world is complex, and I see this movement and this need for dialogue and this need for always coming up with new solutions as something that's part of living together and being human. That's clear. But that being said, now I see great injustices being done that are easy to point to. So, now, in Spain, we got this money from the central government or the central bank in Europe. This money should have gone from the central bank, first of all, from where does the central bank get the money? Either it makes it, okay, and it can make some more and then try to adjust, or it gets it from the countries, right, that contribute. When this money needs to be given to the country, why is it that the central bank doesn't give the money directly to the country that needs the money? That seems logical, right? And you can build some interest there, but that should be, for me, the logical thing to happen. That is not how it happens in Europe. The central bank lends the money to an intermediate banking institution. And the intermediate banking institution lends the money to the Spanish government or the Greek government or the Portuguese government or whatever government is in need, with a difference. When the central bank lends the money to the intermediate banking institution, the interest rate is 1%. When the intermediate banking institution lends the money to the Spanish government, the interest rate is 6%. Why? Why? What sense does it make? Why do we have to build inside of a rescue of a very alarming and desperate social situation and a speculation with private profit for one of the big fortunes in the world? That's outrageous. This is like plain exploitation, it's plain injustice, it's wrong. So if we were to remove this, a big, very big part of this debt would be right away going away. But second thing is, This money didn't come to Spain after allowing this speculation, did not come to be then given to the families that have problems. It was given to the banks, not to them landfall. How can it be that the bank receives the money and has nothing to give back? So now you have rescued the bank. Now the bank is making profit. So I know nothing. The money was given and that's it. What do you mean? Why do we do this? Okay, if the bank, I was against, I would have let the banks fall and many other things that you can see in our program. But let's follow this logic now. Okay, you had to rescue the banks. Okay, give them the money. But write down something, right? They have to do something afterward. When they start earning money, they have to pay back this money. Or they have to give them these 3 million flats that they have empty to the people for a social rent. Or something, nothing, zero. And in the States, the same thing. So why is it happening? Why are we allowing it? To me, it's very clear, right, that some political decisions are being made, and these political decisions are not serving the common interest, are serving particular interests. And for me, one of the other issues that you might be well aware, maybe at the London School of Economics and in Britain in general, is this attempt. We are already in the fourth or fifth set of negotiations between United States and and Europe about the free trade agreement. That's outrageous again. The free trade agreement with the protection of investments between the United States and the European Union, in the fact, what it means is, if you want to look at a very clear example, The Guardian published something, but I have in mind an article from the New York Times, 13 of December of 2013. And this is an article that if you write Philip Morris and that, it will come. An article about Gambia in Africa, saying Gambia in 2010 passed a law, the sovereign government, parliament, right, what we want in Catalonia to be sovereign, Gambia is sovereign. So they passed a law in the parliament saying we're going to try to limit the consumption of tobacco that's rising among teenagers especially by doing what in Spain we already have, these the tobacco packs. They say smoking can kill and things like this. Okay, yes, we are all in agreement. We passed the law. 2010, we are 2014. This law has not been implemented. Why not? Because as soon as they passed it, Philip Morris denounced the government of Gambia because it was interfering with its interests. How can that be? How can a private company sue a sovereign parliament because it's interfering with its interests when the sovereign parliament is passing a law that's good for the citizens? That's what the free trade investment allows. And these governments, these big companies like Philip Morris, have thousands or hundreds of list of lawyers. They are employed only to do that. And Gambia doesn't have hundreds of lawyers to sue back, or not to sue back, because the current agreements on what will be allowed under this free trade agreement is that the big companies sue the government, but not the other way around. And where does need to be decided? What kind of jury or what kind of tribunal, right? Tribunal is right. Court. The court cannot be in the country because that's part of the problem, and cannot be in the country of the business because these businesses are offshore and are everywhere, right? So it is something called, it's in Spanish, Tribunal de Arbitraje Internacional, International Court, arbitration, right? International Court. This is an outrageous figure in the international law. This is a tribunal with three judges that are being paid by the companies because they are being paid by the work that they do, that they don't have an appeal right, the governments don't have an appeal right, and that are there to defend these interests against the sovereign government. This is a frontal, if this is not a frontal attack on democracy, I don't know what else do we wait for. So for me, the solution goes becoming conscious that this is happening and reversing all these politics.
Can we take three comments and questions together and then you can respond to what you want?
I don't have a paper, but I hope I'll remember.
So we'll go to the back and then Sister Gemma and then you.
Thank you very much for your talk. Can I ask what you think of the current political movement in Spain, Podemos?
Okay, Podemos and Sister Gemma.
I'm conscious that in Tony Blair's government, his spokesman Alistair Campbell said, "We don't do God," meaning the government doesn't do God. And that in Britain, trying to mix politics and religion is always thought to be bad, mad, and dangerous. Mm-hmm. So when recently the Catholic cardinal in this country, complained about the number of people who were using food banks, the government said that this was an illegitimate entry of religion into politics. So how would you advise people of faith do politics, and how would you advise people in secular government to listen to people of faith? Mm-hmm. Because without that, there can't be a dialogue. Because mm-hmm. there is no space. There is no perichoresis there. Or very little.
Mm-hmm. And mine's going a bit more theological, but your talk about clarity triggered me to think of Emmanuel Levinas and his sort of first philosophy, first ethics, the first philosophy, but more in the idea that the diagram of ethical action for you is God's impulse into the same world and we carry forth into a mission. Mm-hmm. So here we have our alterity pushing the individual forth. How do you feel that in a world of diverse, in a world of sustained and positive diversity, this other relationships of alterity work? Does it follow the same diagram as our relationship with God? Or does it take a different form where a transcendent other is not the case, and instead that we have a grounded, real other?
About
the rain for you there.
About Podemos, right? These I'm overjoyed, right? And they won. Podemos, we were in talk with them before they were actually ready to be public and all throughout. So Podemos is this, well, you know, political party that has concurred to the European elections and has won 8% of the vote and has 5 people to the European Parliament. And as a very, very young party of 3 months old, that's a very amazing result. And of course, it speaks to me of this urgent need that I mentioned during my talk that there is already a majority, 8% is not a majority, but I believe there is a majority that wants a radical change. But it's not yet, even with Podemos, it's not yet organized in an effective political strategy. But Podemos represents the best that I can see now in the total of Spain for a partner for Procés Constituent, our own movement in Catalonia, because Podemos not only has engaged itself clearly for the social justice and for a model of rupture with the current politics and for anti-capitalism, like we do in Procés Constituent, but he has also, the people of Podemos have also spoken favorably about this right to self-determination, right? Because they link that not to any identity politics, but they link that to democracy. It's like, how can we be consistently democratic and try to preclude that a nation or a region that has particular history and particular language do not exercise this right. So that's my very favorable, ready to work together and hoping and wishing and that it keeps growing, right? And I think there is a potential for that, but it's not easy, huh? So it's not like, oh yes, this is like, no. That's, of course, the opportunity is there, but the mighty forces against it are mighty and I have no clue what will happen. But I know one thing, it's worth it to fight for it. So the second one with Blair, right, with Unto God, and how you mentioned about the cardinal, the Catholic cardinal, I have not read that or know about it, but I know about the Anglicans. The Anglican bishops wrote a very beautiful document about the crisis that I used many times to say, what are the Catholics doing, not in England, but in Spain, right? Why didn't they say something about, of course, then Pope Francis came and he wrote an encyclical, and that's all very nice, but it was after, right? So the Anglicans first, they were able to point to the critical, point the critical, radical discourse against what is happening in politics, in the sense that this cannot be a politics that the majority of people are upholding, because it's a politics against the person. It's a politics that put the money in the center and not the people and all this, right? So I think in England there is space for also say these things. I don't know, because I have not read how the cardinal said it and if there was something inappropriate. I don't see that a cardinal or a religious constituency can dictate to the government what they have to say. I also wouldn't like that, and I don't see that's a good situation. But of course, and I have said it already, there has to be a public forum for all kinds of voices, and the voice of the church has to be part of this public forum, and I think this is already happening. I don't know the English situation very well, but I know when I was at Harvard Divinity School, the talk was about public religion and public theology even, right? That's one hot topic, meaning that the Christian religion, but also others, but the Christian religion particularly cannot be a private thing. That's something that calls us to a social engagement. That's by definition. So one thing is to seize power with a to go there and to stamp it with the seal of the church, which I don't wish to do. I don't think that would be a nice thing, even if it were a church for liberation theology, but that I don't see a theocracy as a possibility, so we don't do God from the government. I agree with that. The government has to be not linked to any particular religion, and I am all for it, and I don't like theocracies, and I think where they have, where we do have them today in the world and in the past, the society is a totalitarian society and something I want to be away from, right? That's very clear. But that's one thing, to break the alliance or to build the alliance between the cross and the canon, and that we don't want, and have these three synoptic gospels saying, give to Caesar what's to Caesar and to God what's from God, right? So directly interfering with policy in that direct way. But another thing, which I'm all for it, is to build up what's called the popular power in a democracy. And popular power, it means that I don't believe in professional politics that do their things and they represent the people and they are voted every 4 years and in between they do whatever, and you can only have the chance every 4 years to penalize what they did. I'm all for the creation of new institutions that we have to think about how they should be between all of us, and these new institutions have to have place for all kinds of voices from society to come to discuss with each other, to inspire each other, and then finally to end up becoming policy through institutions that are not under the control of any church. Is that clear?
Clear.
Okay. and then for Levinas, right, and the ethics, I'm not sure if I have gotten the point, you correct me, but of course I'm clear from where it comes, the inspiration for me, but I also mentioned a bit in passing, and I can stress it now, that as I was 15 and I read the Gospels, it was not an idea that I had been completely going in another direction and now I discovered the direction. It was my own family, with all its anti-clericalism, and the school I went to inspired me in this direction also, from human values, from solidarity, from Catalan wishes of free country and all these things politically and socially. So for me, it's not possible to actually acknowledge like a very separate type of outcomes. Motivation, yes, I'm ready to acknowledge some people are religiously motivated, some are not. That's very clear. And this separation, it's clear for me. But the outcome is like, how do I deal with you because of my religious motivation, and how do you deal with me in case you are not religiously motivated or somebody else? The outcome, I don't see much different. I actually was puzzled by the fact that when I was in the United States doing my medical residency, I was friends with a woman who actually came from India, and we are still very good friends. She's also a physician. Today is an oncologist researcher in the United States. Manisha Shah, she comes from India, and she's Jaina, from a Jaina family, right? And I had such a good friendship with her, and I could see how this kind of challenge, mutual challenge, and it was so going so well that I thought, but with many Catholics, I don't have that. So what it means? Maybe being Catholic is meaningless, right? If in the practice, I mean, it's very important in the idea, but in the practice, I get not only the people from Opus Dei as example, but people that are not particularly right-wing in the church, but still, I could have a proximity, and not a proximity of uniformity, as I said before, but a challenge, right? A mutual challenge going on. So this is one example, but I have so many others. So for me, I am an alliance in alliance, and I am a companion of all the views on humanity that touch this court, like Levinas, that say the other is something, somebody to respect, but it's not somebody that is out of reach in the sense of you cannot engage, right? You cannot control, but there is a possibility, because today in so-called postmodern anthropologies, there is also this idea, each person is a world. And you cannot reach, you cannot breach. It's an illusion, right? If I try to say I'm talking to you, no, I'm talking about my projection of you that I have in my mind, and it's never you. Well, I'm not for that, right? That's too complicated for me. It's like I'm talking with you, not with the whole of you, because you are dynamic too. But I am getting something real if we both are participating in the dialogue freely and lovingly, which means openly, right? Yes.
Why don't you take it off afterwards? I think there'll be the things to do. I regret we really have to draw this to a close. Do please sign up for the Faith Centre newsletter on the Faith Centre webpages of the LSE website. And the best way to find out what's going on here on a regular basis is to like our Facebook page, which I called Faithbook the other day accidentally. And thank you all for coming, and thank you enormously to Sister Teresa. You've given us a great deal to think about, and I think you've equipped us to think about co-creation and to be co-creators. So I hope you all leave inspired, and we thank you for that.
Congratulate you for such a beautiful building, and especially this camera.